In business, first impressions are everything. And that's why every business owner needs to know about Ruby. Ruby is the virtual receptionist company who screens, transfers, and takes messages 24/7, all while making your customers feel special. You definitely don't want to hire a subpar front desk person. And with Ruby, they engage with your callers in a conversational way, just like your best employee would. Never miss another customer call again. This year, make your business the best it can be. Visit ruby.com today. Or just call them at 844-900-RUBY. Hey, everybody, if you want to tell the world something or sell the world something, head on over to Squarespace, because they're going to help you build the website of your dreams. Say you want to sell some custom merch. Well, you can set up your online store. Whether you sell physical, digital, or service products, Squarespace has the tools you need to start selling online. So go to squarespace.com/stuff right now, and you will face a free trial. And when you get ready to launch, use our offer code STUFF, and then you'll save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. How could you go wrong with Squarespace?
Welcome to Stuff You Should Know, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, and welcome to the podcast. I'm Josh, and there's Chuck, and Jerry's here too, and this is Stuff You Should Know. And before we start, Chuck, I want to take a moment to take the opportunity to take the chance of wishing you a happy birthday.
Oh, thank you.
Ides of March, same day Caesar was stabbed. Can't get over that.
Anyone famous get stabbed on your birthday? I don't think so.
No, definitely not.
All right, well, we'll have to change that. By stabbing you.
That was sinister. I even wished you happy birthday, and look what I get. I get a stabbing threat.
I know.
What has become of us, Chuck?
Thanks, man. The big 5-3, such a notable birthday.
Yeah, I feel like also, does it feel any different than the 5-0?
No.
I feel like also we need to give a retroactive happy birthday to Jerry, too, from last month.
Yeah, that's true.
Happy birthday, Jerry.
You know, I did the ultimate 53-year-old guy thing for my birthday. I went to Athens, Georgia for 2 Bob Dylan shows.
Wowee.
That were exactly alike.
Were they really? He played the same show?
Yeah. Bob Dylan doesn't say, like, oh, let me mix it up for if anyone wants to come the second night.
Oh, I'm actually surprised. I could totally see him playing different shows depending on his mood or whatever he felt like that night.
No. Well, that, I mean, there is something to that, but he's 83. He's got his set locked in right now.
Is it really? He's 30 years older than you.
I know. And he's still playing live music.
That's awesome. Could you understand a word he said?
Yeah, it was very a vocal forward set, actually, like some real quiet music, and his voice was out front in the mix. Mm-hmm. I've seen Dylan a lot. It's always, you never know what you're going to get. So it's always, that's part of the fun being a Dylan fan is like, ooh, I wonder what he's going to be like this time.
Is he in a bad mood tonight?
No, he was great. He's old though, man.
But yeah, 83 is very old to be getting on stage and playing. How long of a set?
Like an hour and a half, wow. 17, 18 songs. He played, he plays piano full time now, which is sort of the new change.
Okay.
But he stands, I've never seen anyone do this. I've seen people stand at a keyboard, but I've never seen anyone stand behind a grand piano the entire time, basically.
That is unusual.
He would sit a little bit, but he'd sit for like 6 or 7 seconds and he popped right back up.
Wow. I don't know what's going on with him. That's interesting.
Anyway, we're here to talk about arson investigation. Big thanks to Livia for her help with this because, you know, I was just kind of keen on like, hey, Livia, put together an article on like how that works and how they figure out if someone burned something down. Mm-hmm. And she came back pretty quickly and she was like, oh, Chuck. Guess what? It turns out, like, we can talk a little bit about that, but the real story here is the fact that arson investigation, for most of its time as a thing, has been a lot of sort of witchcrafty BS.
Yeah. Folklore.
And that's the real story, yeah.
Mysticism, made up. Intuition is probably about the kindest way you can describe how it was for decades.
Like, did you see Backdraft?
No, I didn't actually. Isn't that like a Ron Howard jam?
Yeah, back in the day. But De Niro plays a arson investigator who is very much fits. And, you know, he apparently hung out with like 3 or 4 arson investigators and kind of got his performance from them.
Sure.
Which makes total sense now that I've read this because there was a lot of like, not mysticism, but really like, you know, smelling something and like sniffing something he chipped off of a wall.
Putting
and,
your fingers on the railroad tracks.
Feel for yeah, like really corny lines. Like one of his corny lines is, you know, the only way to kill it is to love it a little bit.
Man.
So it's very much in line with what we found out here, which was that arson investigation has long been just not scientific.
No, and there's like we're not just here to poke fun at arson investigators because they used unscientific methods. The big problem with this is those unscientific intuitive methods have been proven time and time again to be just utterly wrong, but they're used still to this day in some jurisdictions to put people away, sometimes for life, sometimes to death. Some people have been put to death under the junk science that arson investigation is and has been for decades and has only recently started to really kind of come in line and become a scientific endeavor.
Yeah, for sure. So big thanks, Livia said, to a couple of gentlemen, Douglas Starr and David Gran. They wrote some pretty great pieces, Douglas Starr for Discoverer and David Gran for The New Yorker.
Can I just say David Gran's New Yorker article, it's called Trial by Fire, about Cameron Todd Willingham and his wrongful execution. I think basically everybody should read that article at some point in time in their life. It's just gut-wrenching.
Yeah, yeah. Great, great investigation. Great journalism. And so let's get going here. I guess the first thing we should say is that the first people to get involved in arson investigation were not scientists. Like, it was sort of developed as a thing by firefighters, by cops, by law enforcement generally, and not people who understood the scientific method. The first book about fire investigation was called Fire Investigations.
Very appropriate.
No colon. It was published in 1945 by Harry Retheret of the Fire Underwriters Investigation Bureau of Canada. And it was very much written for an audience of law enforcement to be like, all right, here's your handbook if you want to prove arson.
Right. That's the big problem with it is, in addition to it basically being like old wives' tales and folklore, it came from the position like if you're investigating this, if you're using this book, you're trying to prove arson, not you're trying to figure out what started a fire. And right. It may or may not have been arson. It's here's what to look for arson. And the problem is a lot of really common features that are found after a fire were attributed wrongly to arson. And this is where it started to spread all the way back in 1945.
You know what a better title would have been?
What?
What to expect when you're expecting arson.
That was an all-time great, Chuck.
Oh, thank you. I just thought of that. So that book was sort of the standard until 1969, about 5 years later or so. A guy named Paul Kirk, biochemist this time and forensic scientist at the University of Cal Berkeley, published a different book called Fire Investigation.
Well, it didn't have the S, so it must have been the prequel.
Yeah, this one should have been called Fire Investigation, colon, you won't believe how much has changed.
So Paul Kirk, being a scientist, he's like, no, you really want to track down what started the fire and then start making your assumptions after you've collected evidence and analyzed it. Don't start from the premise that this is arson and then look for signs that support your premise. That's wrong. That's not how science works. The problem is like Paul Kirk was like, use the scientific method. And the fire investigators said to Paul, there's not a lot of science for us to compare our findings against. Someone, help Nanny State. And the Nanny State swooped in and improved everything forever.
Yeah, about 8 years later or so after that book in 1977, there was a government report that agreed, hey, there's not a lot of stuff going on. And so there were a couple of guides put out, arson and arson investigation in 77. Which was based on surveys from leading investigators, and then the Fire Investigation Handbook from 1980. And we should just kind of read through like this quick list because this was the general thinking of like how you can tell if it's arson if these things are there in the burned house.
Right.
I'll do the first one. Everyone knows this. the most severely burned area of the house is where it started.
Yeah, it just makes sense. That had the opportunity to burn the longest, so it burned the hardest, right?
Makes sense.
Totally.
All these make sense.
Also, heat rises, which means fire rises and smoke rises, so the ceiling is always the most burned part of any given room, which they call compartments in fire investigation lingo. And that if you find burned floors, that automatically says an accelerant was used because you dump accelerant on the floor and light it, and that's how the floor gets charred. Telltale sign, if you find a charred floor, an accelerant was used.
Also, if you see a puddle-shaped char on that floor, that's another telltale sign for liquid. Because smoke spreads out, if you see a V-shaped soot mark on the wall, that is going to literally point to the origin of the fire.
Right. And another one that kind of was an umbrella category for some subcategories is that an accelerant-fueled fire burns hotter than any other kind of fire. It also right. burns faster as a result. So that means that all sorts of weird stuff happens in a hotter, faster fire. For example, something that they call crazed glass, which is glass that has this weird webbing of cracks through it, which they're like is, again, an indicator of a very hot, fast fire, which indicates an accelerant was used. So you find glass with webs in it, that is a surefire indicator that somebody started this fire using some sort of accelerant or fuel.
Yeah. They said that stuff's, it's craze. And they went, don't you mean glaze? I said, no, let's just call it craze since it's so close to another glass term.
Right. He goes, I hadn't thought about that. That makes it even better.
So Nixon, believe it or not, kind of got things going in 1973 when there was a report from that administration that fires caused more than $11 billion in damage, killed 12,000 people in 1973.
It's crazy.
A lot of this was found out to be exaggerated, but it didn't matter because that kind of lit a match, no pun intended, under the government's butt to get into this. And they created the and funded the Center for Fire Research, which is when they basically said, all right, let's get 100 engineers to really look at this from an objective point of view and come back to us with some good stuff.
Yeah, one of the early things that came out of this that was really groundbreaking was called the cone calorimeter. And it was invented by a guy with the wonderful name of Vytenis Babauskas, who is a fire safety expert to this day. And the cone calorimeter is essentially like a vent hood, a giant vent hood that has a ton of sensors attached to it. And you set something on fire, say like a specific kind of couch, and it records all sorts of different things, the chemical composition of the gases that are released, the opacity of the smoke, how hot it burns, how long it burns. It even has a scale, so you can measure, you can compare the weight of the soot compared to the weight of like what the furniture was like before it caught fire. And you can take all this and put it in a database. Like what you're doing now is carrying out repeatable experiments to produce data that people can use to compare their findings to, which was, again, the problem that fire investigators were having that the nanny state swooped in and helped. And this is how they helped.
Yeah. And just to create an image in the viewer's mind's eye, if you're picturing that thing as some humongous thing where you set a couch on it, that's not the deal. It's very small, actually. And it looks like a little camp stove, sort of, with all these things hooked to it. So you cut a piece of the couch off is what happens.
Actually, they have larger ones, too, that you can set essentially a house on fire underneath one.
Oh, well, okay. But I'm talking about just the general lab version.
Okay, okay, okay.
They have them bigger than a house?
Yes, I saw that in some labs that they have, like, house simulations in. Wow. The roof will be the calorimeter.
Oh, okay.
So it's like all sorts of different sizes. We're both right, I think, is the happy outcome of this.
Okay.
And there's also another experiment that, or another finding that these experiments yielded, which was flashover, right?
Yeah. I could have sworn in the movie Backdraft, they called that backdraft. Maybe that's a similar term, or maybe it's the same thing, or maybe it was a, oh, it is? Okay.
It's a backdraft seems to be a component of a flashover.
Oh, okay. Well, I guess that makes sense. So a flashover is when you've got a fire going in a house, you've got a big layer of smoke that's got all kinds of like combustible gases, all sorts of little particles that are super flammable mm-hmm. up in that smoke. Mm-hmm. It's at the ceiling collecting and collecting and then just getting more dense and going down, down, down as the room heats up. Mm-hmm. And then as it hits a certain point, basically a high enough temperature to ignite it, there it's like an explosion, basically. It can hit 1,000 degrees. And when that flashover happens, you can see char marks and burn marks that previously people were like, the only way to get that is if you like dump gas all over a room.
Right. And that's 1,000 degrees Celsius, like 1,800 degrees Fahrenheit, right? That is really hot. And it happens, there's a really steep incline where that temperature just increases like that. And everything, stuff just spontaneously catches fire because it's so hot. It's reached the ignition point for that couch or that TV or whatever. The whole room catches fire. And like you said, it does all sorts of, it leaves all sorts of telltale marks that had long been attributed to arson. For example, the idea that the floor is charred, or another one is kind of related to the idea that if the floor is charred, an accelerant was used. If the underneath, or if the bottom of a couch, what's that called? The underside of a couch, the undercarriage of the couch.
That's where the socks are.
The fanny of the couch. If that's burned.
It depends on what country you're in.
That's true. If that's burned, then they were like, well, an accelerant was used. It spilled over under the couch and caught the couch on fire. No, when the whole room becomes what's called fully involved, the whole room's on fire, the bottom of the couch can very easily get burned. Same with the underside of the bed and any furniture and the floor. So that was a big finding too. And then the other thing about the flashover is it can basically stop and stay in suspended animation until oxygen comes in and it catches fire again. But wherever that oxygen's coming from, the fire follows in like a line, and it can go around the corner, up the stairs, through a bedroom door and out a bathroom window. If that's where the oxygen's coming from, the fire will follow it. That is what a backdraft is, in my understanding.
Okay. I think I haven't seen that movie in a while, but that sounds about right.
Okay. Cool.
Even though it was a movie-fied version, you know?
Right.
I think the science in it was supposed to be pretty good.
Oh, was it?
Yeah, I mean, it was Ron Howard, you know.
So what was this is like the early 90s, wasn't it?
Yeah, it seems about right.
I mean, this would have been, so one thing that you'll find when you start looking into fire investigation is, you know, Paul Kirk wrote that book in 1969. And over time, like more and more scientists got involved in fire investigation, but it's still like percolating throughout the field. Like, so in the early 90s, there was still a lot of hokum involved. And I'm sure Backdraft repeated a lot of that too.
Oh yeah. That the whole character was sort of, you know, that mystical guy who understood fire, yep. You know, more than anyone.
Yeah.
Another big thing happened in the early 90s, besides the movie Backdraft in 1991, was the Oakland Black Hole, a big fire in Oakland, California, that destroyed about close to 3,000 homes. But it was a really good chance to go in there as a fire investigator and kind of see what happened. They looked at 50 different houses, and they found, you know, sort of the normal things that you might find when you're thinking arson. Mm-hmm. But one of the big things they found was that crazing on the glass. They did some experimentation with that glass, and they found, they basically said that this whole notion that crazing is because of arson isn't true at all. It's when they spray the windows with that water, and it's at a really high heat that it cools super fast. That's where you're going to get it. And this is one of those that seemed really like they should have known this earlier, just because people have been blowing glass and working with glass for so long. Mm-hmm. I'm surprised someone didn't know that before that.
That was a finding from that Oakland Black Hole.
Yeah, like it wasn't one glassmaker that was like, oh, by the way, if you get it wet, that happens.
These like this industry or field doesn't even listen to Supreme Court or other court rulings. They're not going to listen to some glass blower.
Yeah, that's true. Those are as hippy dippy as it comes.
The other thing about that Oakland Black Hole opportunity, because you like they knew what caused the fire. They knew for a fact it wasn't arson in these houses. They were originally planning on examining 100 houses. But the features and characteristics that they found were so uniform that they stopped at 50. The group agreed, like, we're not going to learn anything from another 50 of them. We totally got this. Like, it's that repeatable. Like this is what happens when a flashover occurs. All these telltale signs of arson are totally made up.
Yeah.
I say we take a break, Chuck, and we'll come back and we'll talk a little more about arson investigation.
Hey, everybody, we want to talk to you about LinkedIn, because LinkedIn isn't just a job board. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals that you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role.
Yep. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place.
On LinkedIn, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Hire professionals like a professional on LinkedIn.
Yep. So post your job for free at linkedin.com/SYSK23. That's linkedin.com/SYSK23 to post your job for free. Terms and conditions apply. All right, game off. Let's pause here to talk more about Monopoly Go. Because in Monopoly Go, you can team up with your friends for timed tournaments where you work together to build up each other's boards. It's very nice.
That's right. And the more you win together, the more awesome prizes you unlock. And there's so much to get. I'm talking about unique stickers that you can trade with friends to complete albums for big prizes, cool new playing pieces to travel the boards with, or hilarious emojis for taunting friends when you smash their buildings or heist their vaults.
Plus, Monopoly Go feels new and exciting every day with constantly changing tournaments and challenges, like digging for treasure or a robot pachinko machine. And there's always new timed events that help you win big, like massive multipliers for everything you win or rent frenzies.
That's right. There's always something fun to discover in Monopoly Go. So get off the bench and go download it now for free on Google Play or the App Store. Game on!
Today's episode is brought to you by Altoids because, let's face it, unraveling the mysteries of the universe is tough work. But with Altoids, your breath will be stronger than a black hole's gravitational pull, more intense than an alien abduction, and more reliable than your phone's battery during a podcast marathon. When it comes to needing intense freshness, Altoids have you covered. Altoids are stronger than your favorite conspiracy theory, more intense than the latest true crime docuseries, and more reliable than a Bigfoot sighting. They're not just mints, they're curiously strong mints. Find Altoids in the checkout aisle. Grab your tin today. So there were a couple more huge landmarks, I guess, in the late 80s or mid 80s, early 90s, as far that really pushed arson and fire investigation forward. One was a terrible hotel fire from New Year's Eve 1986 in, I think, San Juan, Puerto Rico at the DuPont Plaza Hotel, which I think was a Sheraton at the time. The hotel was in a dispute with its workers over a union contract, and some disgruntled workers set a bunch of furniture on fire in one of the ballrooms and ended up killing like 98 people. The fire spread really quick. The reason why this is such a landmark is because some people armed with all this data that things like the calorimeter had produced came in and created computer models. And essentially what they found was their computer could show that this fire happened exactly as the witnesses said it did, and ultimately led back to the origin, which was those three disgruntled dudes in the ballroom setting the furniture on fire.
Yeah. So the problem, though, as you mentioned, is that you're not going to get these two scientists from the Center for Fire Research on every case of every burned house in the United States.
Right.
So it's, you know, that was one of the biggest problems. I guess one big milestone was the Lime Street fire in 1990. This is another case where it's really sad. There was a guy named Gerald Lewis in Jacksonville, Florida. He was charged with arson and murder for setting his house on fire, killing his wife, her pregnant sister, and four kids, and got out with his son. No one else was able to get out. And he said, hey, my son started this fire. He's playing with matches on the couch in the living room. And arson investigators came in and said, you know, in the traditional way, and we're like, no, there's no way. There was an accelerant here. There's that puddle char on the floor, that V pattern that we talked about, which should, you know, literally point to the source of the fire, mm-hmm. is not pointing at that couch. And this is a big case. Prosecutors called in a guy named John Lentiti from Georgia. He was a fire investigator. And John DeHaan, who wrote or co-wrote at least a manual on fire investigation, to basically come in and say, hey, can you come in here and confirm that this guy's lying so we can put him away? And Lentiti walked away from that investigation and said, well, at first, he looks like he's guilty to me, mm-hmm. So I can confirm that. You should go ahead and prosecute. But then they got a chance, and it seems like these opportunities are a real big thing in fire where, like, hey, we actually have a little bit of money to run an experiment here. And that is when they recreated this house right down to the kind of couch it was and everything that was in the house, basically, and set that couch on fire to see if it would burn like that, and it did.
Yeah, the prosecution spent $20,000 to recreate that fire in a house like one or two houses down that was exactly identical in structure to the one that Gerald Lewis had been accused of burning down. And, I mean, they went all out to recreate it, so much so that they brought some family members in and said, does this look like what the house looked like in the night of the fire? And they said, yes, this is it. Like, it's like it's eerie. So they started by setting the couch on fire, like basically trying out Lewis's account of events. And everybody involved in this experiment just expected the fire to kind of like maybe start to slowly catch and then sputter and go out. Like the sofa was not just going to catch. So they were all really surprised when the fire caught and then caught the other cushion on fire and then all of a sudden caught a big portion of the room on fire. That was the first thing. And then after the fire really burned and they evaluated everything, they were like, all of these things that are supposedly arson related, they're here. Like the couch being set on fire produced all of those things that is being used as evidence against this guy.
Yeah. And this was a huge change for Lentiti personally, mm-hmm. as an investigator. He was basically like, he said, I had an epiphany. You know, almost sent a guy to die based on these theories that were a load of crap, was his quote. So that not only sort of changed his way of thinking, it started a change in the industry. But like you mentioned earlier, one of the problems is that getting that stuff to trickle down to the local, you know, level is really, really hard, especially in a profession where they seemed really, really kind of stuck in these old methods of I'll just call it the De Niro way.
That's a great, great name.
And it was really hard to get that information. Even if they got the information, a lot of them were still like, no, you know, it's not a science. It is a lot of intuition, so much so that in 1997, the International Association of Arson Investigators argued against the Supreme Court. There was something called the Daubert Standard, which basically said in 1993 that, like, hey, the scientific method has to be used if you're an expert testifying at a trial.
Right.
And they said, no, that's great, but not for us, because this isn't a science, and we should be exempted from that.
Yeah, that was 1997. Paul Kirk wrote the book in 1969, everybody, remember. And so you'd think, okay, surely, shortly after that, the industry would have come around. And that's absolutely not true. In 2011, the National Fire Protection Association, which now puts out what's considered like the gold standard manual on arson or fire investigation.
Yeah.
Back in 2011, their manual said that if you use the process of elimination and couldn't determine what started a fire, you should probably go ahead and assume it was arson. So if you didn't know what the cause was, go ahead into court and testify that it was probably arson, and that guy should get the death penalty for murder because of the people who died in the house.
Yeah.
2011, Chuck.
Yeah. It's probably a good time to talk about that case you mentioned, the Cameron Willingham case. Mm-hmm. This is in 1991. It was in December of 91 in Corsicana, Texas. Cameron Willingham and Stacy Willingham lived in this house, burned down, killed their three children. Stacy was gone at the time. It was, you know, just before Christmas. So getting Christmas presents for her kids. Cameron said that, you know, there was so much heat and smoke that he tried to get his kids, but couldn't, had to get out of the house and call for help, was, you know, what he thought was the best method. And this was one of those cases where the local fire assistant fire chief, Douglas Fogg, and a guy named Manuel Vasquez, who had a lot of experience as an investigator, mm-hmm. came in and identified these charring spots, what they called pour patterns, like you poured gasoline or something. The V patterns that they saw, which is where the fires are supposedly started. Yeah. They found in the hallway where the kid's bedroom was and at the front door, like this was clearly someone trying to trap people inside. And this guy did it.
Yeah, that essentially he started by pouring accelerant in the kid's bedroom, walked backwards out of the hall while still pouring accelerant, and then all the way to the front door, and then lit a match. And this Vasquez guy, if he wasn't one of the people that De Niro hung out with, I will be really surprised. Because from what you are describing him, from what I've read, he's exactly that kind of guy. His work,
He probably was.
His work was later criticized, like when we said that it's been described as mysticism. They were talking about this guy's report on the Willingham case. He had tons of experience. So he was very widely respected in the field of fire investigation. Something like 1,200 or 1,400 fires under his belt as an investigator. The thing that sends a red flag up about him is he said most of them were arson. There's nowhere on the planet where some high percentage of fires like that is actually arson. Maybe Detroit in the 90s, maybe Detroit, but certainly not just in Texas in general, right, where this guy was working. So he was apparently one of those people. He died in 1994, but he was apparently one of those investigators who started backwards from, this was arson, or I see that telltale sign of arson, so now I have to figure out what else supports that theory. And he did. And his report was very damning. It was very convincing, and it helped put Cameron Willingham away. There were some other things that the prosecution used about Cameron Willingham that is super early 90s, late 80s Texas. He had an Iron Maiden poster in the utility room, the Can I Play With Madness poster, you know, where like somebody's punching through Eddie's head.
I don't know the poster, yeah, well, if that's what you're
asking. It's worth looking up. It's a work of art.
Okay.
The fact that he had an Iron Maiden poster up meant that he was interested in death and probably involved in Satanism. Like he had a tattoo with a skull with a snake around it. So obviously he was a killer of children. And their whole premise, their whole theory was that he had murdered his one-year-old daughters and 1 2-year-old daughter by fire because they were getting in the way of his lifestyle of like hanging out and drinking and going out. And he was prosecuted and ended up in 2004 receiving the death penalty. And most people who are familiar with the case point to it and say, this is a clear example of an innocent person being executed.
That's right. In 2004, this is many years later, obviously, he was scheduled for execution. And a guy named Gerald Hurst, who was an investigator who had gotten some previous charges dropped against someone else in a similar case, some people got together who were, you know, supporting Willingham mm-hmm. and said, hey, you know, you're the best at getting someone off. We don't think he did this. Can you help? He went in and said, well, first of all, the report from Vasquez, the first line says, in order to kill fire, you have to love it a little bit. And that's just weird.
It's a red flag.
It's a red flag. No, he looked in and saw a lot of issues with their work. First of all, the assumption that only, and this is one of the big ones, that like only an accelerant could have caused a fire this hot. That's one that you see, or used to see at least, a lot in arson. Mm-hmm. Investigations, like it had to be gasoline or something because it was so hot. The crazed glass again, that's another one. We've already been over that. And then he started just looking at the account. The more he looked at it, he was like, you know what? This seems like it real, or the evidence. He said, the more I look at this, this looks like it really matches up with his account of what happened. The other thing we didn't mention too was that they found mineral spirits at the house. And when Hearst looked into it, he was like, this mineral spirits they found was on the front porch by the grill, and that's what he used it for.
Right.
So, like, that's not a piece of evidence.
No, so this guy, this investigator, Gerald Hurst, just completely demolished the evidence that was used to convict and eventually execute Cameron Willingham. But the Board of Parole and Pardons, is like, they got the report and they apparently didn't open it and voted to uphold the conviction and execution. And so, like, this is, I think, when the Innocence Project was just starting. I don't even know if they'd come around by this time. The problem with arson cases, because other people have gotten off thanks to people like Gerald Hurst who've come back and been like, hey, like, criminal courts aren't super savvy and you're still listening to arson investigators who are using folklore on the stand to convict people. Here's an actual scientific analysis of what the evidence shows. Like, it can get people off, but it's so not a smoking gun like DNA evidence is. Instead, there's a different interpretation, and it's quite possible it wasn't arson. And is that enough to reverse a conviction and set somebody free from prison? Not necessarily. So it's still kind of like there's still plenty of people probably who were convicted of arson on junk science that are still in prison, is I guess what I'm trying to say.
All right. We need to take another break, right?
I think so.
All right. Let's take another break. We'll talk about where we are today with arson investigation. Like, truly things have changed, right?
Surely. All right, game off. Let's pause here to talk more about Monopoly Go. Because in Monopoly Go, you can team up with your friends for timed tournaments where you work together to build up each other's boards. It's very nice.
That's right. And the more you win together, the more awesome prizes you unlock. And there's so much to get. I'm talking about unique stickers that you can trade with friends to complete albums for big prizes, cool new playing pieces to travel the boards with, or hilarious emojis for taunting friends when you smash their buildings or heist their vaults.
Plus, Monopoly Go feels new and exciting every day with constantly changing tournaments and challenges, like digging for treasure or a robot pachinko machine. And there's always new timed events that help you win big, like massive multipliers for everything you win or rent frenzies.
That's right. There's always something fun to discover in Monopoly Go. So get off the bench and go download it now for free on Google Play or the App Store. Game on!
Today's episode is brought to you by Altoids because, let's face it, unraveling the mysteries of the universe is tough work. But with Altoids, your breath will be stronger than a black hole's gravitational pull, more intense than an alien abduction, and more reliable than your phone's battery during a podcast marathon. When it comes to needing intense freshness, Altoids have you covered. Altoids are stronger than your favorite conspiracy theory, more intense than the latest true crime docuseries, and more reliable than a Bigfoot sighting. They're not just mints, they're curiously strong mints. Find Altoids in the checkout aisle. Grab your tin today. Hey, everybody. It's time you heard about Squarespace. Squarespace has the tools you need to create and sell your own website. Whether it's an online course or custom merch, Squarespace has you covered.
That's right. Courses is a great program. You can start with a professional layout that fits your brand, upload video lessons to teach techniques and skills, and tailor your course with a powerful Fluid Engine editor.
That's right. With Fluid Engine, which is a next-generation website design system, by the way, it's never been easier for anyone to unlock unbreakable creativity.
That's right. And don't forget the commerce side, because after that, you can charge a one-time fee or you can even sell a subscription.
Yeah. So turn your creativity into income with Squarespace courses. And right now, go to squarespace.com/stuff for a free trial. And when you're ready to launch, use offer code STUFF to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. Squarespace.
All right. So, you know, if you follow the news there, you can see a lot of, I guess, ground being gained as far as overturning convictions on arson. But it's a tough one. Like you were talking about before the break, it's, you know, it's hard to get overturned. A lot of the evidence is just gone, obviously, because it was a fire or maybe the investigation to begin with wasn't done well and stuff wasn't saved. So it's a hard thing to get overturned, even with the new science that we have these days. It's not like a lot of other cases.
Right.
There's the NFPA 921 : Guide for Fire and Explosive Investigations, which this was published in 1992 to begin with. And this is the gold standard you're talking about, right?
Yeah, it's the gold standard now. It's also, I think, the same manual that said just assume it's arson if you can't figure out what started it.
Well, they've been updating it, obviously, right, every year, which is what they do with guides like this.
Sure.
They just, I guess, ripped a lot of pages out. And this is sort of, it's a book, though, that's not as much, it's aimed more toward, like, insurance companies and law firms, because a lot of this stuff is, like, a lot of times when you see something really investigated or reversed, it's because of a big civil case against, like, a drapery manufacturer or something that's getting sued because their curtains went up, you know, too fast or something. Mm-hmm. And so they had the kind of money to pour into a defense that wouldn't happen in a criminal trial.
Yeah. So over time, civil courts have become way more savvy as far as fire investigation goes, as on the whole, compared to criminal courts. In criminal courts, it's still very possible that kind of pretty poor evidence can be admitted and used against somebody. And that's not just the courts who are at fault. Like, it's the investigators themselves who are, at this point, resistant to change. If you're not getting on board with the idea that science is showing, like, yes, there's a lot of stuff that's wrong with traditional arson investigation or fire investigation, you're resisting now. There's just, it's yeah, been disseminated too widely for too long. And I mean, I guess I can understand where that resistance comes from, because all what your training was handed down from people who had decades of experience and knew what they were talking about, and you venerated them because they were an old veteran of the fire department or something like that. Your beliefs are now being challenged. Your intuition mm-hmm. is being derided as superstition and folklore, and you're probably being treated like a bumpkin. You also probably believe that these eggheads are freeing convicted arsonists from prison, or trying to, at least. So what the hell's going on? The world is topsy-turvy, upside down. I'm not De Niro. I haven't hung out with any arson investigators, but I would suspect, based on everything I've read, that that would account for any resistance or pockets of resistance that are still left.
Yeah, I would say so, probably. And you know what? It's probably one of those things that as people age out and retire, the new generation of a better understanding will probably, you know, probably be the one in the forefront, I would hope. So we'll talk a little bit about how you can actually find the origin point of a fire in a more scientific way. It's a tough thing, obviously, to find where a fire started once a fire has, like, fully burned down a house. There have been studies, even. There was one cited by Beattie and Oliva. Oliva, sure.
You don't need me at all.
That if a fire started to burn for just 3 minutes after the flashover mm-hmm. happened, that investigators basically couldn't tell what quadrant of a room, not even like the very spot, but even what quadrant that the fire originated in, any better than chance.
Right.
3 minutes after the flashover.
Yeah, but...
So all this to say, it's really, really hard to do.
Oh, for sure. Because the flashover, again, it's full involvement. The entire room's on fire. They did say that if the fire's put out within 30 seconds of flashover, they're right about 84% of the time.
Hey, big difference.
It is a big difference. But they have found that there are some reliable ways of tracing the origin of fires, or tracing the source of fires, right? So if the V-shape, I don't think we ever said that V-shaped char that used to, like, be considered to literally point to the source of the fire, those form where opposite, where an oxygen source enters in a flashover room, a room that's in flashover. It just yeah. forms that, right? Or they also found that, like, puddling, those puddle marks, pore marks that clearly show accelerant, those curtains on fire from that drape manufacturer, when they fall and hit the ground and burn, they can leave the same kind of marks, right? So if you have all of these confusing signs that just don't make sense anymore, how do you find the source of a fire? And as I was saying, they have established, there are some that are just genuinely telltale And they might not say this is arson, but they can kind of lead you to where the origin of a fire was, and hopefully you can figure it out from there.
Yeah, for sure. One way is to look at the bodies of victims. It's obviously a very sad way to investigate something, but you have to do it. And they have found that people, if you're really, really close to the fire, you know, I think most people think like, oh, no, you don't die from the fire. You die from carbon monoxide poisoning. That is true if you are further away from the fire. Mm-hmm. If you are very close to that fire, you usually die from edema, in which the airways of your body swell up from the heat, mm-hmm. And your organs shut down from the heat, which is, I got to imagine, a terrible, terrible way to go.
Right. So depending on the arrangement of the bodies throughout like a house, you can kind of trace who was closer to the origin of the fire, the source of the fire, right?
Or at least where it was, you know, hottest.
Right. Okay.
Which isn't always where it started, as we now know.
That's true. There's another one called arcing that's pretty interesting. As a fire melts the insulation on wires in the house, like the electrical wiring, the electricity can jump from one exposed wire to another, and it causes an arc. And that's you can tell that just by looking at two electrical wires where an arc happened. That can only happen while the power's on. So you can actually kind of say, okay, this arc happened at this point in the fire because the power went out at this point, or we turned the power off at this point, so this arc couldn't have happened after that. Which helps walk you backward toward the origin point of the fire, or the direction of it, timing-wise.
They also have just a great database now. It's called the Ignitable Liquids Reference Collection Database. Mm-hmm. Or the ILRCD. Not bad. Doesn't spell anything, but that's fine.
Okay.
And that's basically, if you find just any flammable liquid at the fire site, then you can just send it to the lab and they can at least tell you what it is.
Right. There's also guidelines now for people who aren't fire investigators, but are likely going to be the first people on the scene, like firefighters or EMS, that kind of thing. And it's just stuff to be on the lookout for so that you can tell fire investigators later what you saw. Really?
Iron Maiden shirts?
Yeah. Did they have an Iron Maiden poster? That's one. You had to move a refrigerator to open a door to vent the fire or something like that. Was the refrigerator plugged in? Was the appliance turned on? This space heater that we think might have been the cause. Was it in the on or off position? When you show up to a scene, are you seeing somebody who you've seen at other scenes?
Yeah, that's a big one.
And firefighters are like, yes, I have. The paramedic did it.
Right. They're
like, no, like in the crowd, like not working the fire, like somebody who's in the crowd. And they're like, oh, no, I haven't seen anybody.
Yeah, that's a good one. If there were any like electrical line issues that you could see, or whether, or like if you see a big winds cause a tree to fall nearby or something, those are kind of obvious things. But again, these are for non-investigators. What's another one?
Another one, keeping track of what people who are witnesses or who were in the house or the structure when it caught fire are saying and telling you.
Right.
Especially if they say something like the paramedic did it.
Yeah, totally. I got interviewed one time by a fire investigator.
What?
Yeah, I kind of forgot about this. My brother and I, we used to love exploring sort of abandoned homes and things.
And setting them on fire?
No. Although I did have a little fire thing for a little while. I think a lot of people go through that phase. Mm-hmm. Nothing big, just like, you know, ooh, I'm going to set this stick on fire in the woods. Very dangerous, though, even though nothing happened, by the way.
Take note,
just want to make it clear. Yeah. There was a abandoned shed across the street from us. It was a house. The people moved out. New people moved in and built a really big house, but left this old shed. And we had been in it exploring, and it was just full of junk. And we, as a young child, I was probably like 10 years old, mm-hmm. was quizzed by the, I guess, the cops a couple of weeks later, my brother and I, because it turns out that the people said that there were a lot of really expensive things in there, and it was a big insurance claim.
Wow.
And I think he burned it down and said there was a bunch of expensive stuff. Mm-hmm. And he was, I believe, looking back, he was thwarted by those darn kids.
Wow. And their
dog,
too?
No, we didn't take our dog in there. But I remember just it was like, no, man, that was a mannequin and a bunch of files and just some framed pictures. It was junk. It was junk.
You're like, I remember the mannequin because Scott pretended to kiss it. And I think he actually did kiss it.
I don't know. I don't remember. We never had to like go into court or anything. So I'll have to ask my mom kind of what happened with
that.
That's
nuts.
I just remember that. Yeah.
What a great anecdote, dude, to end this with.
Well, I appreciate that.
So
I made it all up.
That's fine. We'll edit that out. I guess the upshot of this is if you know a fire investigator, an arson investigator, give them a hug and say, let's stick to the science. If you want to know more about that kind of thing, go out and research. There's a lot of really interesting stuff to read about arson investigation. And you could definitely do worse than reading David Grand's Trial by Fire in The New Yorker and Douglas Starr's article in Discover Magazine. I think Spark of Science, maybe? Something like that. Check it out. Oh, that means it's time for listener mail. Sorry, I fell down on my duties.
That's right. Brutalism follow-up here. Hey, guys, while listening to that episode, I was delighted at the mention of Habitat 67. As a McGill student, Habitat 67 has been touched on in a number of my classes, especially because this architectural staple in Montreal was designed by McGill alumni Moshe Safdie.
Nice.
I wanted to share a fun fact about the development of Habitat that I learned in art history a few years ago. During the design process, Safdie used Lego blocks to help him model the building design. In fact, he used so many Lego blocks that he bought out all of the Legos at a number of Montreal toy stores.
Wow.
Pretty fun. Anyway, thanks for all you do, you guys. Stuff You Should Know is always my first podcast recommendation to others and has helped me become a more inquisitive person over the last few years. So keep up the good work. And that is from Kestrel Musselman. Great name.
Great name, for sure. Thanks for that story. We appreciate it. The great Lego shortage of 60-something in Montreal.
Yeah.
If you want to get in touch with us like Kestrel did, man, that is a great name, you can email us. Send us an email to stuffpodcast@iheartradio.com.
Stuff You Should Know is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Hey, if you haven't heard of Visible, well, now you have. They're the wireless carrier that's making wireless visible. It's in the name. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon as low as $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. Use promo code STUFF20 to receive $20 off your first month for listening to this podcast. Switch now at Visible.com. For data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com. The Visible monthly rate is $25 per month.
Childproofing people's homes is hard, but Duracell is making it just a bit simpler. Not only are they committed to educating parents, caregivers, and medical professionals about the importance of battery safety, they make the only lithium coin batteries with a non-toxic bitter coating to help discourage children from swallowing them. Duracell even features child-secure packaging designed to avoid accidental opening. Learn more at Duracell.com/powersafely. Available on 2032, 2025, and 2016 sizes.
Life in our modern age comes at you pretty fast, which makes our time away especially valuable. When I take time to relax, I like to get far from my everyday life, immerse myself in natural beauty, and have unique experiences. But you don't have to leave the U.S. to experience tropical rainforests and islands filled with adventure, warm culture, and national treasures. Visit Puerto Rico, an island with a vibrant spirit that will sweep you away. Because when you visit, you don't become part of the island, it becomes part of you. In Puerto Rico, you can forget where you came from and embrace where you are. Puerto Rico, where visits end, but stories last forever. No passport required for U.S. citizens and permanent residents. Learn more and plan your trip at discoverpuertorico.com.